ruthless enemy.
27 people murdered.
A deadly strike. That's a changeling, the galaxy's most ominous threat.
The changelings have reached Earth.
Has just hit home.
Earth is in your hands, gentlemen. Do what needs to be done.
Now, for Sisko.
We have a war on our hands.
This time, it's personal.
Earth is defenseless.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, shifting Cam's furniture just a centimeter to the right... Just a centimeter to the left.
That was you?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Okay, we have a very special guest. Silently trying to figure out whether it's Tyler or I who is the changeling. Patrick Johnston.
Or am I?
Oh, dear.
Well, we'll have
There are five of us.
Yeah. We'll have to do blood samples.
Right. Don't we do that normally every week?
Yeah.
So this week's conundrum, we are going to talk about the Star Trek Deep Space Nine two-parter, Homefront and Paradise Lost.
Cam, an exciting episode based on your memory, or did you, I don't know, what was your memory going into this one before you hit play most recently?
I had none. Really. Like, okay. I looked up the synopsis on IMDb, like, because it didn't jump out at me the way that, like, Way of the Warrior did, for example, which we did last time we covered DS9, and I was like, oh boy, those titles really don't jump out at me. So, when we talked about Improbable Cause, or The Die is Cast, I looked up those synopsis, and I was like, oh, of course I remember that one. This one, I was like, that sounds vaguely familiar.
Okay.
That was sort of my take.
Patrick, when I ran into you at 7-Eleven a few weeks ago...
That was fantastic, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I pitched this to you. I remember you kind of shrugged your shoulders. You're like, oh, yeah, that one? Okay. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts
The memory was rather... I was like, cool, I love DS9. But I was like, that one? Really?
You're like, they didn't give me Way of the Warrior? Really? Okay.
Well, I knew you'd already done that one.
Yeah,
so we saved the gems for you.
Thanks, guys.
You're welcome. We'll see you next time with Basics from Voyager.
Well, for me personally...
Can we do Birthright, actually?
Oh, gosh. Actually, we made my sister do that one. I felt bad for her. But, this one for me, I remember... At the time, I said, oh, yeah, two-parter. That's always exciting. And then I watched this. I was just like, okay, this time around, Cam, you and I were talking about this last week about kind of the applicability of Deep Space Nine and how it seems to grow more topical as the years go on. This episode's from 20 years ago,
right?
And I'm just like, wow, this could have been made like last week, and it seems far more, of the current state of affairs.
I could not agree with you more, Tyler. Okay. Elderly people still won't go to the doctor.
Yes. Well, I don't know. I was fascinated by how...
What a relief to know that they suffer from osteoarthritis in the 24th century.
Yeah. Wouldn't you think it's very kind of treatable?
Well, I would think so.
Like, don't you think like one doctor...
Most of these illnesses, I'm like... Guess I haven't figured that one out.
Yeah,
yet. Like we're almost there.
Not only that, but Bones was like 150 and a counter at Farpoint. How old is Joseph Sisko? Like 65?
You know what? For all we know, Joseph Sisko could be like 105. Just looks like he's 65.
That's true. Peters had it going on.
I know. He's giving Jake Sisko some advice about making love to beautiful women.
That's something you want to hear from your grandfather.
Your 105-year-old granddaddy. Okay, well, for... All those who may not recall, this, of course, is the one where there's concerns that the changelings have arrived on Earth. So Odo, Jake, and Ben, they all head back to Earth, and they're hanging out at Joe Sisko's restaurant, and they're swinging back and forth between Nalines and San Francisco. And essentially, we have a cliffhanger that ends with martial law essentially being declared on Earth. Mm-hmm. And then we follow up, and they're uncovering this conspiracy that Sisko's former commanding officer, now Admiral Layton, has been behind in order to make the Federation frighten them into taking more drastic measures against the Dominion threat here. So, Cam, your thoughts now on this particular two-parter?
To borrow sort of a phrase from Roger Ebert's, history of film.
Thumbs down. Doing.
No, not thumbs down. I really like what this episode is about. I don't like how it's about it. To me, everything in this episode is like, I should really be into this.
Okay.
It's hitting all these beats that I really love in a great DS9 story. It's just doing it in ways where I'm kind of like, okay.
Do you think the episode is lacking a certain amount of tension?
Tension, yeah. Stakes. I never felt like, this gripping paranoia was really overtaking Sisko the way I think it wants me to believe it is. I think there's also issues maybe with casting and character writing, like Admiral Layton, who I'm sure we'll talk about later. He feels a lot like the Bernie Casey character from The McKee.
Sure.
Whereas I thought Bernie Casey was far more charismatic and just interesting as a, introductory one episode character than this guy.
I have to admit, I completely forgot about Bernie Casey from The McKee until you just brought him up.
But when he was there, he was magic, right. Damn it.
Sure reminds you a lot of Admiral Eric Pressman, doesn't he? Which, just so interestingly enough, I watched it totally randomly last week.
I think Pressman's got way more on Admiral Layton, though.
Layton's kind of, yeah.
Tell me, Patrick, your thoughts about this episode. Fast forward, it's been a while since you first saw this.
So, better than I remembered. Certainly. Yeah. Cam, your point, I think, is probably spot on. There was a lot of good stuff. Mm-hmm. It's very uneven. You go and look, you can see why there's good stuff, because there's three really good writers tied into both parts of the episode. You got Ron Moore, you have Robert Hewitt Wolf, and you have Ira Stephen Bear, guys who get what this show should be about.
Like home run hitters almost every time out, yeah.
And, there's some really, really good scenes. That scene, I think it's in Homecoming, the first episode, between Brock Peters and Avery Brooks, where they're arguing about, should you be tested?
Right. I think that's honestly my favorite scene from the two-parter. Yeah.
It's incredible. And I was reading a couple things online that say that might have been one of the best scenes in the whole series.
Well, to me, the whole time I'm thinking, what right does Starfleet have to test family members?
And this was something I'm sitting back, I'm like, there are broader things to be discussed, and we can talk about them now or throw them out there. What the hell is the Federation?
Yeah, I know.
Because
yeah.
It's the super, this whole idea. And in many ways, I think this is Deep Space Nine starting to get into sense of, okay, maybe we can talk about some topics. Right. Because, this is the super progressive future that Gene Roddenberry's imagined, where there is no conflict. They've solved all the problems. And yet we keep running into bad admirals doing bad things.
Yeah.
And, like I said, Eric Pressman. How do these guys... I mean, maybe it is Peter Principle stuff that these guys are just...
Sure.
They kept getting, okay, well, you can be in charge, Guys that sit behind a desk and they really can't affect very much, but they get these strange little projects and then they got caught.
And sorry, just to back up just a little bit, because I forgot if you mentioned it, but... Joe and Ben, they're essentially arguing about whether or not Joe should be taking a blood test to see if he's a changeling. And Joe's argument is like, I have nothing to do with Starfleet. Why on earth, as a family member, should I be doing a blood test? I'm never around any sort of Starfleet facilities. I'm just your family member, Ben. And screw off. But you're bringing up other stuff about Starfleet. Do you, and the Federation, do you get the sense that the UFP is a bit of a nanny state to a certain degree?
Well, there's certainly always been a suggestion of that, but it's sort of this, it's a democratic socialism or something. And it's in the end, the people in charge are smart and they know what they're going to do. And they're not nefarious. It's benevolent and it's for your own good, which is essentially Ben Sisko's argument when he's talking to his dad. He's like, what are you worried about? It's just a test. It's not the end of the world. And he's like, screw you. By the way, I'm an actor who came up in the civil rights era and I know what the hell it's about. Well, which was great casting. I mean, Brock Peters, casting in that, for sure. Because he owned that scene.
And for those who don't recall, he was in To Kill a Mockingbird, that film adaptation, which fantastic in that. Mm-hmm. But you said something interesting. You said, the leaders of the Federation are smart and they know what to do. Cam, did you get that sense from UFP President Inyo?
Oh, yeah. He was swell.
Yeah. Very assertive, Equian sort of dude.
He was the Vedic Barile of Federation presidents.
I was really sad that we didn't get an introduction to Vedic Barile in this to be the voice of reason or something.
I think he was dead by this point, wasn't he?
I couldn't remember. Yeah. I knew you would know, though.
Life support. I think he died season four or three? Three? No, I think it was season three.
I think three.
Yeah, because I don't think Worf was around to mourn for Brile.
Right. There was something I wanted to mention about this episode that kind of ties into what you were saying about the Federation kind of being the be-all, end-all and everything. You know, so often in TNG, we've talked about how the people on Starfleet are like these superhumans that are not relatable. Like, they feel like these gods, essentially. Kind of like the DC heroes versus the Marvel, you know. Marvel are kind of the scrappy, kind of street-level guys or quirky, idiosyncratic types, whereas the DC ones are like these titans. That's how Star Trek feels, where it's like the Starfleet and TNG, I'm just like, I could never be a member of them. Like, I wouldn't belong. And I like how this episode, even though it's not an episode I think is spectacular, we get to see Joseph Sisko, who's a very normal human person, looking at Starfleet being like, they are not normal.
Yeah.
Like, they do not know what's going on with the average person.
Well, it is always great when we can, you know, take Starfleet down a peg.
Yeah.
You know, and this is fascinating. It's interesting. You see father figures like Richard Bashir, Joe Sisko. They're just kind of normal dudes.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see how they're able to raise these sons. Although, you do recall when Odo asked if Bashir had anyone on Earth he wanted to say hello to, Bashir said no.
I thought that was super interesting.
Yeah.
Although, of course, they didn't really know that whole scenario yet. But I was like, well, that's kind of a lucky fluke there, I guess.
They mapped it out about 4 years ahead.
They were way ahead of the curve on that one. But Tyler, what was your thoughts on watching this episode?
I was, again, just struck by how topical Deep Space Nine is. And maybe we can get into, let's start delving into maybe a part one first. But I will say that there's a lot of talk about loyalty in part two that seems eerily similar to what's going on with a certain leader down in the United States right now.
Right.
But also this whole paranoia about proving who you are, it seems, and your loyalty to whatever you're a member of, you know, I think it's so applicable to what's going on in society.
It's Red
nowadays.
Scare tied in with Nazi Germany stuff. It's,
yeah.
It's actually
Islamophobia that we're seeing in society.
It in many ways is sort of classic science fiction storytelling. It says, here's a problem we deal with now, and here's a futuristic twist on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's one of those things that I'm like, this was actually, that it drives the episode really well, and it is one of the strengths of the episode. I totally get what you're saying earlier, Cam, about just the sort of the way it works. It is rushed, and I think in many ways, I mean, oddly enough, they already had done a three-parter, so why they couldn't try this out as a three-parter, because it's sort of like, well, here's a problem, let's do this, here's a problem, let's do this. You know, it didn't allow for really any development. Like, you know, like you said, Layton's a bit thin, the president's super thin. Where are the other politicians when they're having the big scene where they're trying to convince them? And he has to make, so it's a dictatorship, but it's not. We know there's this council, and we know probably just couldn't afford to put extras in the room, and there you go. But you know, I'm sitting there going with that. I mean, Captain Benteen, who literally is there, I mean, I was thinking about it. I'm like, why is she even here? And then you realize, oh, because they need someone that you know to Captain Dakota to have that conflict. But then you're like, she just goes, oh, you're right, Sisko, yeah, they're not bad guys.
And she's played by Susan Gibney, who played Leah Brahms on TNG. So she was a pretty major figure on that show. And then you look at the casting, the acting job she had on DS9, it's like, you know, not exactly equaling a fairly, you know, well-known character on TNG.
And again, like I said, it's kind of the, you know, there are these issues that speak to us now, especially.
Yeah.
But they kind of rushed it, and they just didn't seem, they weren't in that mode yet where they would become within a season or two where they're like, all right, we're building multi-episode story arcs that are going to meander along, and we're going to figure it all out. Because, like, this is a crisis that it got wrapped up in 90 minutes.
So I think there's kind of a couple issues here, because, Cam, I do agree with you with regards to the lack of tension.
Yeah.
But then I also agree with Patrick saying that they rushed it, and that's kind of a weird
rush to me too.
It's a weird thing to have where something feels rushed but it lacks tension to a certain degree. I will say, though, sticking around with Homefront, part one of this two-parter, I do appreciate we had a lot more character moments in the first part of this one, especially with Nog and Joe Sisko. It's funny, don't you think, like, Joe Sisko is such a well-defined character by the end of part one compared with, say, a Layton or a Benteen that was introduced just now?
Which might speak a bit to the actors. I mean, Brock Peters is a legendary actor. He was. And
And he serves chilled tube grubs to Nog, which, you know, he's the only guy that'll do it. So I can appreciate that.
Are you implying that Robert Foxworth isn't a legendary actor?
Oh, he's been around. He's a good dude.
Is he?
Sure.
I'll take your word for it.
Got a long, long filmography. Appeared on a lot of stuff over the years. But I don't know. I mean, again, I think it was a case of... It was kind of underwritten. It's like, hey, you used to be Sisko's guy. Sisko likes you. Thought you were a good commander.
Well, it feels so much like the setup for Calvin Hudson in The McKee, where we're introduced.
Great example.
Oh, Ben, remember those adventures we used to had and when we served together? And they're, you know, setting up for him up for a heel turn, which I think works far better the first time in The McKee than it does here.
Yeah,
and
was anyone surprised?
No.
I'm not going to lie. When I first watched it, I kind of was. I was like, what the heck's going on? Like, this is bad. Because if you, like, for something, it was interesting because this time around, the fact that this opens with a terrorist attack didn't linger with me. But when I do, you know, as I was watching, I was thinking, wait a second. When I was younger, I was like really caught up in like, this is a bad situation. What are they going to do? And they're trying to figure this all out. And, you know, they got to convince the president to do whatever. And you're kind of going, that's what's going on here. But this time around, partly because I remembered how it plays out, but I was just like, oh, he's up to no good.
Let's talk about his motivation just a little bit. And I think another important thing with regards to topicality, as well as the President Jerish Inyo, like Leighton says explicitly, like Inyo's not taking the measures that he needs to because he's not from here. He's an alien. He might be the president of the Federation, but he's not from Earth, which is something that I thought very, very topical now, more so than when I watched it the first time. But it's interesting that that's how Leighton's prism, his viewpoint of the world, or I guess the galaxy, works essentially. How well thought out do you think Leighton's motivations are as the antagonist here?
I mean, I think he's ultimately there to serve a point of what this episode is about, which obviously is about the idea of Starfleet taking martial law. And that's, I feel like the writers were interested in tackling that element. They weren't interested in tackling the character of Leighton and what he wants and how it drives him. They wanted to tackle the idea of Starfleet having martial law, and he's the vehicle to get to that.
Do you think they could have solved the Leighton problem with just maybe giving him at least one scene, having dinner at Joe's or something like that? Just give him a little bit more...
Well, he has coffee at Joe's.
Yeah, but that's in part two after already figure out that he is the villain.
Or he has the talking villain scene.
Yeah.
You know what I was thinking? I would have... Because Odo is in this two-parter a lot. He's down on Earth, you know, essentially representing the concept of how a changeling could attack Earth. He's giving security ideas to the Federation, which I loved.
He's a double agent. I mean, it's in a certain level. This is now a Cold War spy story.
Yes, and I would have, and it's based actually on a 1964 John Frankenheimer thriller called 7 Days in May.
Oh, is it really?
That was what it was inspired by. Yeah, but I would have loved actually. I really thought about this after of Odo having a relationship with Leighton, because we know, you know, Ben and Leighton just have this expository background where they're like, oh, remember when we served on that ship? Wasn't that awesome? Yeah. Well, see you later, Leighton. I would have liked to see maybe Odo get closer to Leighton and have that more of that relationship, have some sparks there.
Do you think Leighton would want to get close to Odo? Because I got the sense, even beyond that scene where we had the changeling fly away as a bird, you know, that's who is disguised as Leighton. I still got the sense that Leighton made sure that he called them shapeshifters, which is kind of an offensive term to Odo.
But even if it's
an antagonistic sort of relationship?
Or a relationship where he's hiding the fact that he's essentially using Odo as a means of proving why changelings are dangerous.
He could have sucked it up and kissed Odo's butt a little
bit. Where he's manipulating him,
essentially. Yeah, okay.
That ties a little bit, actually, to something I was thinking about. It was just like, in a way, you know, you have Leighton tied to Sisko. Leighton has, you know, sort of in the way it's written, Leighton has to convince Sisko of his plot.
Yeah.
Or of the plot. And it kind of, it's almost like they're jamming three people into two spots. And then in many ways, like you said, it would have worked better if Odo's been brought as the expert, right? Mm. Sisko doesn't need to go. Sisko's only been invited because he knows Leighton, right? So in a certain level, if, you know, if you write it differently, you make Odo the center of the issue. You make, in essence, you bring Sisko along as kind of almost Odo's conciliary or something like that, or, you know, the guy speaking for him, and somehow Leighton's character becomes more rounded because he's the guy making the call. Because I sat there and I thought, I'm like, why does he need to make Sisko the like temporary head of Starfleet security? And I'm like, what? Like,
I know Admiral Todman was extremely upset that he was displaced. That's a callback to the Dies cast.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so I'm curious, because going into this, like, I thought this was maybe going to be another Odo-centric Dominion, you know, story arc sort of thing, but I was very delighted to see that this was a Ben-centric episode. How do you guys think it functions as a Ben story here?
I think it works in theory, because we get to see Ben as sort of the spearhead of the Federation and realizing that this cause that he fights so hard for does have flaws and it is capable right. of turning in on itself. So I think it's very important for a Sisko, you know, concept episode. It's just something like, I think so much like this would have been a great, say, 6-episode arc on the show where we could see more of the impact this had on Earth, or maybe there's more than one, you know, bombing essentially. Like maybe there's a couple incidents that really throw the like the whole public up in panic. Something where we feel like Sisko feels the panic that is in the streets. You know, those empty streets.
Sure. Yeah. Where they can't afford extras.
Yeah. Well, this was...
With horse-drawn carriages.
Apparently, the story was Way of the Warrior ate up their budget, so they had no money for this episode.
I buy that.
Which makes sense, because in the end, I'm going, oh, man, there's so many missed opportunities. I mean, you want to talk about a Sisko episode. I mean, this is a guy, like, ongoing internal conflict. He argues with his dad. He tells Odo, I wish we had never found your people. Yeah. And Odo basically says, you're right.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is interestingly enough, foreshadowing of like in the pale moonlight, this is a guy sitting here thinking, what outcome do I want?
Well, I
and
think
how it, do I get it? But they don't even get into it that much, because it's like, I'm going to argue with my dad. It's a great scene, like I said, but I'm going to argue with my dad about why we should all be tested, and I'm going to tell Odo what everybody kind of knows.
As a Sisko story, though, I love the family beats. You know, his conversations with Jake, his conversations with Joe. I think this is much stronger on that level. But Patrick, you bring up a good point here, in that I don't think season one or even season four Sisko would have gone down the in the pale moonlight path. I think that's part of his arc there. Like, that's why we see what he does in the pale moonlight. I think if anything, maybe this could have helped him convince him. You know, this experience in this two-parter would have been one of the kind of triggers for his eventual decisions in the pale moonlight. So I don't know if this is one of the most important two-part episodes, but I think there are some values or some valuable things that does offer for the series.
It's part of him buying into his job.
Yeah.
And that from day one, this is a guy that doesn't really want his job. And he's trying to convince himself that this is the right job. And he starts moving towards it and eventually goes, okay, yeah, yep, I am. I mean, this is the guy who's going to be the defender of Bajor. This is the guy who's going to be the defender of Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just think, you know, to me, part of the problem is like, I see all that on the screen, what you were talking about with Sisko, but I never felt like he was racked with the right amount of like, I never felt like the shift from Sisko arriving there versus being like a paranoid wreck worked very well. And I wonder if it would have been better had they had another incident, because we have the bombing that is the instigator for the whole thing. If there had been another incident partway through, you know, say, Homefront, that really just ratchets Sisko's paranoia up. Because we have him come down maybe more in an advisory role, you know, like, okay, guys, here's what we have to do. And then he gets hit again. Maybe he's tied to an event, like he's present for it, or something he feels he could have stopped, which then causes him to be paranoid about, you know, blood testing his father and stuff like that.
See, I was going to ask if you thought part of the issue was directing, but it sounds as if that's a story issue. You know, that
I think
kind
it's
of a failure on the story there. Okay,
yeah. I mean, to me, I totally agree. To me, if you have that opening attack as being not on Earth but somewhere near Earth, and all of a sudden there's this sort of, you know, are they coming this way? Are they here? Do we
Beta
know?
Set.
Right?
Yeah.
And you have, you start going, you know, what are we going to do? And then the attack happens halfway through. All of a sudden, boom, everything they're doing, boom, shift in the story halfway through the episode. Now it's a different story. Now it becomes, hey, Mr. President, we told you.
And he right.
Goes, you know, it to me that, you know, it would have worked better. It wouldn't, instead of just this cliffhanger going, oh, well, I guess you're right. Here you go.
So let's ask this question. And do you think Sisko and Layton, or Sisko, based on everything he knew at the time, was he right to go to the president of UFP and say, look, we need to put Earth on lockdown? Do you think that would be the right decision? I'm wondering what Picard would have been thinking about if Picard was there instead of Sisko.
It's a great question. I mean, I think Picard probably would have honestly probably been going in a similar direction. But again,
really? Okay.
But...
See, wow. I thought Picard would say, no, we cannot give in our rights. You know, like, I think that's where Picard would
There would be a huge rights discussion, absolutely. Yeah. No, I what I was going to say was...
Not an argument with an angry father?
Well, there would be medication. A long speech about what's going on here, and, you know, no.
It would be a fist fight with Robert.
Rolling in the mud.
Yeah. The Picard comparison thing is really important, because that, especially when you think about... Almost from the beginning, Picard is in these roles where it's like, no, this is a complicated issue. It's not a black and white issue, which is Layton. Layton's like, it's black and white. We gotta put soldiers on the street. We gotta...
Three at a time.
They were embedded, Cam.
Oh, I thought of that more than once. I was like, I think I have a note here that says the changelings are embedded.
For all listeners who don't recall, Cam and I love to make fun of the Romulan plan and unification, about how they're going to essentially take over Vulcan with about 5,000 Romulan soldiers. And they kept saying, but they're embedded. They're
you
embedded.
Can't, you can't get rid of them.
Yeah.
And four changelings.
Well, okay. Well, that's in part two. I want to get into it in part two a little bit. About this, sure. That discussion, which that's actually one of my favorite scenes in part two. Before we get there, any final thoughts? How does this work as a first part of a two-parter, Cam?
Well, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the president. Because this character, like Iris Stephen Bear, says he was not happy with it. The end result.
He's no Kurtwood Smith.
He was based on Jimmy Carter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was apparently what the writers envisioned when they created this character.
As like kind of the feckless sort of like whiny sort of leader. I
mean, does this character work at all?
No. He seems just way too feckless, and I'm just like...
Would he ever be a president?
But the problem is... Well, okay, here's the issue. It's like he's written away in that he's seen as so, you know, kind of toothless that it's like, oh, well, you know this guy's... He's a pushover, you know? So it's like... Can you really have faith in a leader like this? He's not really much of a leader, is he?
It doesn't give you a lot of faith in the Federation, quite frankly.
Well, that's one of my concerns, is that we always kind of see like the civilians, they're wrong. Starfleet's right, the civilians are wrong. And that, I guess it's nice to see in this that...
elected officials can always be disappointing.
Yeah, yeah. But at least, if you're an admiral, you're often
like
wrong.
Like I said, like he's just sitting in a room, he has no advisors. The only advisors are Layton and his... interim head of security.
Yeah, what's that all about?
Don't forget the
is this the Trump White House?
Well, he had the briefcase that he tossed on the desk of the Federation president and turned into Odo, so he had that advisor as well. That was, to me, one of the most memorable scenes, like going into this, like,
yes.
I remembered it so much from when I saw this episode like 20 years ago for the first time.
And say what you will about Trump, he has strong opinions.
It's true.
Whether they're monstrous or not, he has strong opinions. This Federation president does not have any opinions.
No, but you know, I totally think that Layton is now the Trump figure.
Yes.
Like, because in part two, maybe we can segue over to part two. We can still go back and forth. But in part two, Layton has that big talk to Sisko. He says, I need loyal people. And we find out that he's been stacking the entire sector, whether it's ships or people based at Starfleet Command, with like former people that were loyal to him, like former officers, and that's one of the reasons he brings Sisko as well to
Planet Earth.
There was one
named Snowden. Catch that? Why
no.
Was named Snowden?
Oh, okay. I'm telling you guys, Deep Space Nine is on. Like, is Iris Stephen Bear some sort of clairvoyant or something?
I don't know.
I don't know. Okay.
Here's literally a question I wrote down: how does a progressive society allow blind faith command structure? Right?
I know.
I mean, this is the challenge that they end up, that we consistently run into. And overall, the other note I had was, what is it with the gullibility of the Star Trek universe? Like, because they're all like, whoa, really? He's bad? But I'm like, of course. I guess you're all supposed to be on the level, yet you keep introducing these like nefarious characters. You have Admiral Marcus, guys that get, you know, they get all the way to the top, and it turns out they're really bad dudes.
I have kind of a side question. Do you think we'll ever see some sort of Star Trek offshoot series, even if it was a mini series about the politics of the world of Star Trek, because I think that would be fascinating. Because we always see the ship exploratory
fascinating.
Stuff. You don't think so? Because this place is a gong show. It's you run wanna... by like crazy old men.
I think whoever takes on that project, they yeah. need to make sure that it's a gong show and not some sort of hey, look how orderly the Federation is. We must decide how many relief vessels we should send to this planet. I don't want to see any of that. I want to see like this gong. Show.
How did this Federation president get there?
Yeah. Cam wants an entire episode just on the Corridan question.
Yes, I do.
And okay. Gav and you know all yeah. the guys there.
It's just fascinating to me because it seems like as great as Starfleet all sounds on paper, their political structure is a waking nightmare.
Yeah. And you know what, who I'd like to see take it on is Ron Moore, because he made...
That would be amazing.
Well, yeah. He made an effort in Battlestar Galactica. Mm-hmm. One of the things he did not like in the original is how Commander Adama would go talk to the Quorum, and you always knew Adama was right, and the civilian leaders were there all dumb and stupid. He made sure that like the civilian leaders there, they were right a lot of the time, and it wasn't the military that knew all and everything. I'd love to see Ron Moore take on a Federation Council.
So often we see Star Trek admirals go bad. We did a whole episode on admirals who suck.
Yes.
But these admirals climb the ladder. What were they like as starship captains?
Maybe they were just born to be captains, and once you get them behind the desk, they get a little too fidgety or something?
I don't know. I'm fascinated to know about like the captain work of like Leighton and, you know.
Okay, let me ask you this. If Admiral Kirk stayed Admiral Kirk, would he have eventually gone bad like, say, a Leighton or a Pressman or what have you?
I think so, maybe.
I think he just would have gotten stir crazy.
He sure wasn't ready to let go in the motion picture.
Oh, I can imagine. Okay.
And that was him just after, I don't know, a couple of years and sitting in that chair.
In Decker's mind, did Decker envision Kirk as the evil admiral? Like, he was pushing him out of his commands. He didn't know the ship as well as Decker did. He was telling him what to do. I can imagine
Scotty makes a joke about how did you convince Admiral Nagura to let you do this?
Yes.
Because he's still a captain at heart. I was going to speak to what you were saying earlier, which is like, guys, I have a modern example of someone who's risen very high in the ranks and turns out to be a really bad dude.
Oh, really?
Mike Flynn.
Okay.
No, seriously, like just, somebody, along the way. And so to me, that's what I was sitting here thinking. I was going, now, like we have a modern example. I mean, we see it right in front of us and it happens all the time. He's not the only one. There are a lot of people who rise the ranks who just aren't the greatest people, but they do something well that someone else liked and said, no, we need him around.
One thing I've never... Okay, I can grasp Leighton's motivations. One thing I've yet to really figure out what Flynn's motivations are behind all his contacts with Germans and other foreign powers.
Money.
Is that just it? Is he just driven by...
Money.
Money?
So, what is Leighton driven by? Is he driven by credits?
No, I don't think he is.
Power?
He wants to be president? I think he's power hungry. This is essentially his effort to have some sort of military coup on Earth, was it not?
Yeah.
He's had enough of naive presidents.
Yeah. I don't know.
He was Bruce Willis in The Siege.
but I also think he's a little xenophobic as well, because him constantly calling Odo a shapeshifter, him explicitly saying that Inyo doesn't care about what's going on Earth because he's not from Earth. I think this guy's a xenophobe, too.
How can he be in Jean-Luc Picard's Starfleet, though? That's what baffles me.
Well,
if he's a xenophobe, he's far from perfect. This isn't just like it's one little chink in the armor.
I know. Yeah. Look, if we want to look at some police forces across the world, a lot of people say, it's just a couple bad apples. But other people say, no, there's institutional problems there. If we look at Starfleet, I think the Roddenberry worldview is that there's no institutional problem with Starfleet. So I wonder if what we're seeing here is the writer is trying to come to grips with the Roddenberry vision as well as how it just seems to collide with reality. So what are we left with? Is just a whole ton of bad apples? I don't know.
Well, one thing about Leighton, I'll say in his defense slightly, is that we find out he dealt with the Borg, right?
Yep.
So this is a guy who has seen that a new species, when they present themselves as a threat, can be severely dangerous. And the Dominion and the Changelings are a brand new quantity. No one knows what they are. So I understand why someone having dealt with the Borg threat might immediately leap to like, oh crap, these are the next, horrific thing that's going to hit us.
Who would win? Borg versus Dominion forces. Who would come out on top?
I think the Dominion.
Okay.
I think so.
They'd have enough, you know, wherewithal and ingenuity to overcome the Borg.
I think ingenuity is totally it, because they would figure out how do we beat these guys, and then, I mean, you destroy whatever's at the core of it all. They would get to it, because they also, remember, have fleets of soldiers who will literally do what they're told.
Yeah.
So well, let's keep this in mind. The Federation has defeated both the Borg and the Dominion. So that's I think it says something about maybe Federation ingenuity as well.
But I think the Borg looked a lot more neutered after their interactions with Starfleet than the Dominion did.
I completely agree. And you know what? Let's keep in mind, the Dominion, the wormhole closed after season 5 because it was mined, and then the prophets just kept them out of there. So they only had access to a certain amount of resources that were in the Cardassian Union as well. So they didn't have their full access to what was on the other side of the wormhole.
Right.
So one last point. This was, of course, part one was originally supposed to be a cliffhanger for season 3 leading into season 4. Okay. Cam, you brought this up a few weeks ago. How does this work as a potential cliffhanger from one season to the next? Are you waiting at the edge of your seat at the finale when we see people transporting into the streets of New Orleans?
I think from a story point of view, it works pretty well as a cliffhanger. In execution, I don't think it has the sort of the tension to be a cliffhanger. But I think on paper, presented purely as here's our cliffhanger for season 3, here's what it's about, bam, I think it would have worked.
To me, I thought it was a little kind of like some Starfleet officers are carrying phaser rifles.
But like, that's execution. This is on paper presented as a, like, they didn't shoot it and then say, is this our season 3 finale? They are looking at a script and whatever, saying, would this work? I think it does work.
Okay.
I was going to say, as concept, it's a lot like Redemption. You know, Redemption doesn't end like, oh, you're like, oh, Worf's marshaled off the ship. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, but you're like, okay, cool. I can't wait for next season, but I'm ready for the summer.
Just to figure out how they resolve everything.
Yeah. All and right. I'm like, okay. All right. Earth's under threat. You know, there's soldiers on the street.
And that's the thing. I don't think there's anything wrong with this two-parter as a concept or, you know, as a story idea. I just don't think it works as well as it should.
Okay.
And that's what I mean. That's what I mean when I say that I think it was a good story. It had lots of good moments. Underpowered, though.
Yeah.
You know, could have used another part, could have used two more parts, but that would have required some, you know, probably much more ambitious storytelling. I would have required more ambitious storytelling than they were obviously were allowed in this particular instance.
Okay. Speaking of sort of head-scratching story decisions, what did you guys think of the implementation of Red Squad?
I love Ben's line is a secret elite force of cadets. Nothing like this was in existence when I was in the academy. It's like, well, Ben, they're secret, and maybe you just weren't elite enough.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
So. I mean, did you think this is a bit of a clumsy way to tie Noggin? Like, they won't be my friends.
I'm glad they did tie Noggin, because I love the Jake and Nog stuff that we got to see. But I Red Squad seemed okay. That one cadet that we saw, he seemed so like, this is an elite cadet.
Tyler, could we make the elite squad?
He could probably make the elite squad on the tennis team based on like what he looked like. But I don't know. Like, beyond that, he does not look like big Starfleet material.
How's he going to do in the Academy Marathon, I guess?
Oh, yeah. He'll pass that baton. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Red Squad, I thought, was kind of lame.
Shouldn't the Red Squad look more like teenage Makos?
Well, they're supposed to be secret. They have to blend in, right?
Sure.
And were they not really just kind of a ripoff of Nova Squadron from
totally.
From First Duty and Next Generation?
Yes.
Why didn't they just call them Nova Squadron?
They didn't want to pay the writer who created Nova Squadron. That's
really
why. Who are the guys that get the Valiant later on? What are they called?
See, is that
they're cadets too, right?
Is that Red Squad?
I think it is.
Is it Red Squad?
Yeah, but then they have these little like badges on the opposite side of their turtlenecks.
Yeah, but
but
they're cadets.
Yeah, they are, and they get a Defiant class starship to command.
Do you think it's at all strange that the Admiral is sending his secret cadet squadron?
No.
On these missions.
No, because they're like, go do this. They're like, okay.
I guess.
But how much do you trust these kids?
Do you trust high schoolers?
Look, Ben.
Hey, it's Starfleet. They're the best of the best.
Ben is a smooth operator. First of all, he tricks that Bolian admiral into like revealing like there's the secret
with
plan.
Odo hiding next to his screen.
There's a reason he's the security chief. Yeah. And then we get that Red Squad cadet, and he squeezes it out of him. Like, what's going on?
I feel in the book of Sisko's greatest triumphs, tricking those two was not high on the list.
Okay, fair enough. I should mention this though. Admiral Layton. We find out that he was the one that got Sisko over to Deep Space Nine originally. Sisko did not want to be in Deep Space Nine. So did they have a bit of a falling out? Because like Sisko, like the whole tension around the premiere episode, Emissary. Sisko's like, yeah, I'm out of here. I'm going to quit Starfleet because of this stupid posting.
Right.
So, I don't know.
Well, Layton's just looking out for his buddy. He's like, come on, man. Get over your dead wife.
All right. Red Squad doesn't work so much for me.
Can I? The Red Squad thing kind of got me thinking. I'm thinking, man, I wish they could have come up with Section 31 way earlier in the series, because how much better would this two-parter have been?
Yeah, you tie Layton to Section 31.
Right?
What do you think Section 31 is thinking the whole time on Earth while they're witnessing all this?
They're watching 17-year-olds do their work. Yeah. You know,
that's
what?
How they pick the best ones for Section 31.
I'm in favor of Section 31, if only because I don't want 17-year-olds doing my covert missions.
Fair enough.
Are you guys not? Are you not a fan of Section 31?
No, I am.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
Especially.
Yeah. Well, In Deep Space Nine, I liked it. Not so much in Enterprise or Into Darkness. Right.
The sort of retconning of it, I wasn't cool with that. I was cool with it being a thing that existed during this era that, you know, we didn't know about. Maybe you could argue that it existed in TOS. But saying it had always been there, now you're talking about like Illuminati stuff. And I'm like, I'm not cool with that. We don't need that.
I can't really speak about the Illuminati. I'm actually sworn to secrecy. But, when you have...
Don't ask me about being a Freemason either, okay?
When you have a character like Luther Sloan, who shows up later in Deep Space Nine with Section 31, he's such a great character.
Amazing
that
character.
He helps make Section 31 really compelling.
He's a former member of Red Squad, Cam.
Do you think Red Squad...
He founded Red Squad. In fact, he founded Red Squad while he was a cadet. He was that good.
Wow.
Do you think Red Squad would have worked better if we'd been shown like a Red Squad leader who was really charismatic?
Or somebody who seemed ultra capable.
Yes.
Not like Torpy.
Like little Nick Locarno.
Yeah, well, hey, yeah, maybe a little bit of a Nick Locarno.
Yeah.
Like that would have been... You've had to explain why Tom Paris's twin brother was still on planet Earth, but yeah, fair enough. We alluded to this earlier, but one of my favorite scenes in part two was the O'Brien changeling and Ben Sisko encounter, where it took Ben a long time to figure out that he was talking to it. Like, it took about four beats of him saying, you can't get to Deep Space Nine that quickly. No, seriously, Chief, how'd you get here? And it's just like, dude, you're dealing with changelings here, but... I love that scene so much, especially kind of that revelation. And let me ask you this. The O'Brien changeling says, there's only four changelings here on Earth. Do you guys believe that, or do you think he's just messing with Sisko here?
I believe it. Okay. Because, I mean, it's supposed to be a menacing threat, saying, look how we've messed you guys up, and there's only four of us.
But would the founders want to give away some of their secrets?
Yeah, because they know they're the best.
Okay.
Arrogance.
Right? Yeah. They're that arrogant. They're like...
It's like Layton. You know, he's got the talking villain problem.
Yeah.
It's like they feel like they're right and they're going
to
win.
Talking villain being the one who tells you about everything they're about to do?
Right.
Okay. Just so I understood.
What would you guys think of Colm Meaney's performance? He definitely does not seem like Chief O'Brien
here.
Yeah.
I thought it was fun, yeah. And I mean, this scene was pitched as an homage to JFK with the Donald Sutherland scene.
Sure.
And I think it does a really good job of it. It's fun to see, and I like... exposition is really tough to do well, and I think the scene does it in a way where it's actually gripping. Like, I wish there had been more moments like this throughout this two-parter.
The first 10 minutes is really weird, really weird exposition. Like, I get it, but you're like, ugh. And then, like, the throwaway stuff from Homecoming, like, in the end, Odo's annoyed at Dax, but why? Like, why do we care? I mean, I guess.
I love that Dax is sneaking into Odo's room.
It's a great, it's a great little tidbit, but I'm like, why is this here? And then Bashir and O'Brien are on the holo suite, like fighting the Battle of Britain. I'm like, what does that have to do with anything?
And O'Brien has a Cockney accent.
Yeah, and I'm like, that's kind of weird. The Irish guy wouldn't be too stoked on that, but...
Speaking of like little moments from the episode, I love the teaser featuring Quark, where he tells more in the joke, And then the Andorian says, that isn't my antenna. Like, they're still telling dirty jokes like that, you know, all the way.
Oh, I can believe the 21st century. Yeah. Quark is the type that's going to keep them alive. He's gonna light that torch and run with it.
Who does Morn then go and tell that to? That's what I want to know. Because you know Morn loves that joke.
You know, there was that that lady friend that he had in Way of the Warrior Cam. So maybe that's who it is.
I could see someone telling Dax.
Okay.
Dax is the character who I think is... Yeah, sure. Dax is down for it.
Okay. dirty Andorian jokes.
Yeah. But you were saying, why is that scene with Odo and Dax? Rearranging stuff. It's because those characters had basically nothing to do in this two-parter, so you're going to give them a little bit of something.
Now, am I right that Nana Visitor is like super pregnant or something, and that's why we almost never see her?
Was she at this point? She might have been.
I was curious about that. I
think she was pregnant season 5. Okay. Because it was actually the changeling Bashir that delivered the baby, which is an interesting thing to think about. I don't think the writers were thinking that far ahead, but that was in season 5.
Because Kira literally has nothing to do in this episode.
She's religious. Right. You know, and what do you guys think about, we do see Worf serving as the exo on the Defiant, and Kira's at the tactical console. Was that a little disconcerting, because we're used to seeing, for all of season 3, Kira was second in command of the Defiant, now Worf's overtaken her in that role.
I'd missed that. I didn't even thought about
that. Okay. Well.
Because I always just thought Worf, you know, I mean, it's first contact. Worf's in charge of the Defiant. Sure. That's his little ship.
Yeah.
Tough little ship.
Ramming speed.
Were we robbed having Kira, leading the Defiant? Like, would that have been really, really awesome?
For this particular episode perpetuity?
Just in general.
Well, we did see that in season 3. I thought it made more sense to give that job to Worf, though. Like, that's where...
Starfleet isn't Worf always going to shoot first, though?
But it's a Starfleet ship, right, yes. Patrick?
Yeah.
So why would you have a Bajoran militia member take command of...
Because it'd be badass. Okay. That's why.
Oh, look, I enjoyed it in season 3, but, not to take anything away from Kira, who I love, but I do remember it was a complaint at the time that they were giving Kira less and less to do, so it's funny that you bring that up for this episode.
I just thought it was Kira. I mean, I get because they took two characters completely away from the station and put them somewhere else.
Yeah.
And then we're kind of trying to find ways to get them involved, and they mostly have nothing to do.
Well, let's bring this up. What would you guys make of the climax between the Defiant and the Lakota in kind of that who's going to destroy the other vessel? Is it every man for himself at this point?
I felt it was pitched properly, but again, it didn't quite deliver the fireworks you're kind of hoping for.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much of that was budget problems, because again, Way of the Warrior took all their money.
Yeah.
And so I know one of the plans was there's going to be a lot more ship stuff, but and it just wasn't there. But I never felt like the drama of the situation raised to level.
Nobody,
it's one versus one.
But nobody ever worried that one, you know, Starfleet ship was going to destroy another. You all figured that they would come to their senses eventually.
But, you know, we find out there's, quite a few casualties.
Yeah, yeah.
Which means something. It would have been interesting to see kind of the battle at least rage to a point where it's becoming scary. Because neither of these Starfleet ships want to take each other out, really.
Yeah.
But we see they're being pushed into it. And, just because of the budget, they can't do that. And so it feels very... Like, this battle should mean more than your average, battle of the week, but it doesn't really feel like it does.
The weird one about it is, if you think about it, why does the Defiant have to stop to go see the Lakota? Like, to make it actually really logical, the Lakota intercepts them at warp speed, and there's this running firefight. Yeah. And even that would have been better, I think. And the way they set it up, they're like, okay, you lied, they're all bad, they're all changelings. And they're like, okay. And then they're all of a sudden, I mean, that's the thing, all of a sudden Bantine's like, oh, yeah. No, we believe you. We're going to go turn around.
Otherwise, if we don't believe you, you're going to destroy us right away. Yeah, we totally believe you that you're not changelings. All right.
How did you feel about that battle? Were you?
I never really believed that the Defiant was any danger. I didn't think we're going to see the death of about two-thirds of the crew there. Although I will say this. If I was Worf and I had Bashir standing behind my back giving me pointers on how to command, I'd throw him off the bridge pretty quickly. What was Bashir doing on the bridge there? It made no sense.
They needed to give those actors something.
Bashir's always on the bridge, though. He's never has anything to do. And then they get in a fight, and he's like, I'm going to the medical bay.
I know. It's never made sense to me. It's like when I see O'Brien on the bridge of the Defiant as well. He when he's behind a console, I'm just like, dude, you need to be getting to main engineering right now.
Now, Odo's a major part of this two-parter. Did you guys feel like the resolution to Odo's...
The major part was Kira.
The resolution to Odo's story, was it all interesting? Like, did you feel like Odo had a real takeaway at the end of Paradise Lost?
Not nearly as much as I thought he would, just because this is such a Dominion-heavy story. By the end, I kind of forgot.
I'm like, oh yeah, Odo's involved in this somehow. The first one, to me, surprised me that there wasn't more consideration for the pain and suffering Odo's having to go through to test all this
stuff. Which I thought was interesting, like watching him getting zapped by that phaser sweep through the room, you know?
Yeah.
But it is curious, because I think Odo was featured heavily in the previous two-parters that we watched, Way of the Warrior, as well as
Improbable Cause. Yeah, I mean, to me, I think of there's that Enterprise episode where Phlox goes back to Earth and finds out like that people can be xenophobic towards him.
Yeah,
I would have liked a little more of that with Odo.
Yeah, you love xenophobia.
I do. I'm such a fan. I really think that would have been compelling though for Odo to be coming to Earth essentially to help humanity and humanity treating him really poorly.
Right.
Because it would then make him question, maybe, why is he doing what he does? Like, again, I think these are dramatic beats that I think would have aided this two-parter so much.
Okay, guys, before we wrap up and determine, we always declare this, whether this justifies itself as a two-parter, but any final thoughts on part two of this two-parter?
Well, I actually just wanted to quickly mention just what we were talking about with Odo there. I mean, in the Dias cast, we see Garak tortures Odo, and there's a real dilemma there. And I was just kind of like, okay, well, we're shooting Odo, but we just have no discussion of it. Like, Odo, oh yeah, cool.
He's like,
that's enough for one day.
Yeah, can we do? We'll pick this up tomorrow.
Is this in his job description?
Well, he eventually said, "You're going to have to find another guinea pig because I'm done."
He does say that's true. Yeah. But anyway, it was just I found it curious.
But I like how he was in serious pain at level 3.1, and then he's like, "Better crank it up to 3.5." Just like he means business when it comes to the changelings. So.
Yeah.
Okay, Patrick, let me ask you this: Does Homefront, Paradise Lost, do they justify themselves as a two-part episode?
I think so in the end. I mean, I came in here tonight and said, wow, that was a lot better than I remembered. Yeah, yeah. And I, on the whole, for you know all the warts we've identified, it was a good episode. It told a story well. It told the story of a crisis. It presented a lot more about, especially, I would say, Sisko than we had seen to that point. It's really good for his development in terms of him understanding who he is. We've got this great scene, like I said, with his dad. It works on the whole. It's got flaws, but on the whole, I enjoyed it. It was way more enjoyable than I was expecting it was going to be terrible, but it was much more enjoyable than I was expecting.
See, I went back and forth because I was thinking, like, is this really a two-part episode, or could we have crammed everything into just one episode? But then I realized if you did that, you would have had to take out all the character beats that I love so much between Joe and Nog and all those people. Even, O'Brien and Bashir had some great character beats. So I would have to ultimately say, like, yes, but I would put this at the weaker end of the two-parters that we've been reviewing so far, Cam.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like, I feel like the ambitions of what this two-parter was supposed to be just never delivered. And so I'm left with something, does it justify itself as a two-parter? Yeah, it does. Because this story, I think, maybe even needed more episodes to build up more of an arc to it. But, you know, it's like, there was a funny anecdote. Ira Stephen Bear kept a note pinned to his office wall, apparently, which read, "Remember Paradise Lost."
Interesting.
And he said it was to remind him of how we'd screwed up. He said, "To this day, I just can't tell you how aggravated it makes me. It just drives me crazy." But I can understand that, because I don't think this is a bad two-parter. I think it's a two-parter that fell victim to the circumstance of budget, and maybe they just didn't, you know, maybe they rushed it too much in terms of telling the story in two episodes. Maybe they didn't plan far enough ahead. It just, I think that all the pieces were in place to make something great, and it just didn't work for a number of factors. And so we're left with something that I think fits very well into the themes of Deep Space Nine, explores ideas that are very suitable to it, and has moments, like you mentioned, character beats that are just fantastic. It just never gels from kind of like a B-grade two-parter to like an A-grade.
Yeah, I would put this above the Maquis, but say below the die is cast in an improbable cause.
It probably didn't help either, having this follow the way of the warrior as extended length stories.
As we said, I think that so far has been the strongest two-parter full-length episode, whatever you want to call Way of the Warrior, but or extended episode, the strongest one we've seen so far.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. What are your feelings on this two-parter? Are we wrong? Are we right? Let us know. We would like the justification for our opinions.
Or are you black and white like Layton, or are there shades of gray like Ben
Blake Riker?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a deep pull.
I know. Tyler, we're on Facebook. Where in the name of Vedic Barile are we?
Go to facebook.com/subspacepod or just search for us on Subspace Transmissions in your Facebook search bar. As we get closer to reaching more hits, we're going to be putting out more exclusive content. Right now, you can find exclusive videos, exclusive commentaries for episodes. The more likes we get, the more we'll put out there. So keep clicking. And guys, it's a free podcast. All we ask is that you give us a like on Facebook. Have you liked the Facebook page?
I did.
Good.
Yes.
Good. I'm proud.
Thank you.
After you know, you featured the special mini episodes.
Yeah. Right. You know, we're still waiting for Cam to push the like button, but he's very stubborn.
I'm very choosy about what I click like.
I know.
Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Oh, Cam, we are going to be looking at When Star Trek Goes Green. What does that mean, Cam?
An episode on environmental issues, obviously. So I'm looking forward to a thorough discussion about the whaling issues in Star Trek IV.
We had some fun discussions about, say, the Andorians and the Tellarites, some of those old school aliens that did not get enough attention. We're going to be looking at some of the other ones that probably can't justify an entire episode on their own, but we'd like to look more at the Orions, the Gorn, and maybe even another secret alien or two that we won't tell you about just yet.
Green or non-green.
Is Morn green?
Morn's not green.
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
No, unfortunately. We'll have to do a Morn episode on its own someday. Boy, that would be riveting.
It'll be silent.
Pantomime.
Yes.
Okay, well, you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V is in Vague Changeling Threat, Smith.
Okay, well, you can find me at Reporton, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N is in Not My Antenna.
And Patrick.
And of course, I'm at Rising Action, not what you think it is.
Okay, it's not your antenna?
No.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.